Welcome to the final ATP podcast of 2022, and we hope that you're enjoying the festivities, whatever they are, and wherever you are. I'm Seb Lozier, and all I can say is sit back and relax, because you're in for a real treat. Great, legend, icon, all overused words, but I think we can get away with all of them this week. Coming up, Roger Federer, Pete Sampras, Bjorn Borg, Andre Agassi, Leighton Hewitt, Bob Bryan, and John McEnroe. How about that for starters? We have Ukrainian Sergei Stakhovsky on the war and his own tennis career. We have a doubles masterclass. But first, young Dane Holger Rune was recently given the accolade of ATP Newcomer of the Year. And Jill Krabus managed to spend some time with his longtime coach, Lars Christensen. It's a great chat about the 19-year-old who last month won the Paris Masters. And they started with the most important lessons they've learned over the past few years.
We've set goals, you know, from the very beginning, even when he was a junior. You know, we put up the junior in steps, you know, and we did the same when he started doing professional tennis. So we had goals for each year, you know, what should we reach on the ranking and what should be worked on. And I've always been very much into statistics and what was working, what was not working. So, yeah. We've just built it piece by piece.
Well, that's interesting. So you were into statistics from the very beginning.
Yeah. I've been doing it ever since he started playing tennis. So I was, even when he was playing under 10s, I was doing
really?
Statistics on him. And I've kept doing that always. So now I'm working with Mike. So now it's even better.
Okay, so that's interesting. So what has changed? What did you start with when he was super young, 10 years old, and how have those statistics changed as he's grown?
Well, in the beginning, it was more about how many unforced errors contra how many forced and winners he would do in a match, and I would specificate looking more on forehand and backhands, and, you know, getting older, it's more about serve and return and serve plus one and return plus one, and yeah, so it's and it's getting more and more specific, obviously, but I've kept the statistics always, you know, and I always compare during the year how we're moving, and I set goals for the next year that these things that I can see are errors or areas to improve on. And I mean, for me as a coach, it's a very important tool, because I think if you don't know the exact thing, what's going on in the matches, it's so hard to put together the practice and be efficient when you work.
And have these proven ideal? For example, his run in Paris, of course, was just exceptional with who he beat and the route to the title there. Was that very statistic oriented as far as how you approached that particular week?
Not more than any other week.
Okay.
It wasn't so. It's a thing that I've been doing on and on, you know. And I mean, sometimes it's, if he's performing good or bad, it's not about my statistics, but my work is built very much on the statistics. So I know which areas we have to improve, and when he's doing good and he was in Paris, so everything comes together and delivers the good results that he's capable of.
How do you do this as far as relaying the information to Holger? Does he like knowing all that information, or do you pick and choose? Because sometimes it can be too much when the players have all this info.
When he was younger, he was very much into the statistics on his forehand. How many winners did he make, and how many unforced errors, and if it was going up and down, and in some specific matches when the numbers were very good, you know, he was crazy happy about that. I don't talk so much to him about those statistics right now, so I see it as a tool for me to build the practice programs, the development programs. But I notice when there are specific areas in his game that needs to be improved to compete on the level he wants to, I'll inform him and say, we're doing these exercises because your numbers and this have to go up.
Mm. And how gratifying is it for you as a coach? Because you've worked with him since he was 7 years old, is that right?
That's right,
And then to see him now. I mean, I feel gratified for you. It must be so gratifying.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I'm a very calm person, I would say. So for me, it's all very logical. So what's happening, and I mean, it's not normal what's happening at all, because what he has been doing and the way he's performing is beyond belief. But it's been, like I told you, we've been building all this brick on brick, and I think it's coming together right now. He's developing so much, and I mean, also his physics has been in huge development the last year. So it's not like I'm surprised about what's happening.
Yeah.
I think it's it came a little bit faster than what was planned. I planned him to be a top 25 by the end of this year. So top 10 is absolutely better than we thought. But
it's incredible. Yeah. You brought up the physical part of it, because that is something I think you mentioned he wanted to work on. He looks very strong. And watching him in Paris, I watched quite a few of his matches. The way he defends and moves is exceptional. How much time do you work on that physical part of it?
Well, the physical part of it is obviously, the older he gets, it takes more and more space in the practice program. And I would say it's always equal now. The time we spend with the racket and the time we spend on physical training is almost one-to-one when we see it over the year. So we do a lot of work on that. And we've always structured, you know, and when we saw there were deficits that he needed to improve on, I put together programs to develop these areas.
So you do all his physical stuff too?
Yeah, when we're working at the MTA, the Muratoglu Academy, we have a physical trainer who's doing the work, but under my instructions. So normally I would be the one doing the physical training, yeah.
Because you're really very into biomechanics too, right?
Yeah, it's a big interest, and I've been working with that kind of stuff, you know.
So what can you tell us exactly what that would entail? Maybe on a daily basis, how you bring in the biomechanics, and what exactly is your main interest in that category?
Well, it depends, you know, on what we're working on. You know, when he was younger, it was about doing everything right so he would not get injured in the long run. So I've been looking a lot into his stroke mechanics, his running mechanics, and the way he moves on the court, you know, so we don't have things that possibly could ruin his career in the long run. So I've been looking a lot into that. And now later, when he's been growing a lot the last year and two, and so there's been a lot of things, you know, about shoulder protection and the spine and everything, you know, around having a healthy upper body.
I know, that's fascinating to me. So do you work on machines, or do you do body weight work, or how do you do as far as aligning the spine and all that? What does that entail?
We mostly do body weight stuff.
Okay.
On some occasions, you know, we had to build muscle, so obviously we've been working with weights, but we don't do much machines. Sometimes it's beneficial to have machines, because it's easier to isolate some muscle groups if you want to work specific. But in general, we'll use more body weight training.
Yeah. And as far as Holger's mentality, he always looks like he's bringing that passion and that drive every single day. I spoke to another player that had known him since he was 10 years old, and he said that was the first thing he saw in him when he was 10, even, was that drive that he had. Is that something that obviously came natural to him, or is that something that you encouraged?
That's definitely natural for him. It was some of the first things, you know, I noticed when I started working him when he was 7 years old. At that time, I would have like groups of small kids coming in for two or three sessions a week. And normally I will go on Monday, I'll go and introduce a new theme and say, this week we're going to work on this stroke or this kind of mechanics. And I would introduce it on Monday, and then on Wednesday I would work on it again, and then on Friday I would expect most kids to be able to do it more or less perfect. But every time I introduced something on Monday, Holger would do it perfect on Wednesday.
Wow.
And he was just so much into it, so I knew and asked his mother what's going on, you know. And she told every time he came home, he would stand in front of the mirror and would just repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And He was so passionate about it from the very beginning.
Wow, that's incredible. That makes me think, how much do you guys work at all on visualization or anything like that?
I'm not working so much on visualization, you know. Obviously, it's a part of it sometimes when there's a certain thing, you know, a certain movement that that you have to work on. I'll do that, but it's not like a clear part of my plan.
Yeah. And as far as being a team, obviously you mentioned his mom, that communication between you, the parents, and also you just added Martoglu, of course, officially as a coach. I know Martoglu's seen him for many years. How did that come about, and what do you feel like Patrick brings to the equation?
Well, Patrick comes in with a lot of experience on this level, and I've been talking to Patrick over the years about different issues, and we've always agreed, you know, on the way we're going, and I think what Patrick is bringing in is a second voice to say what I've been trying to get through, but from another angle, you know. And then Patrick is very good, you know, at feeling where the player is at the moment, and if there's like small little adjustments that he
as a person or tennis wise.
Yeah, more as a person, I would say. You know, I mean, tennis wise, he has his own way of saying things. You know, we agree on what should be worked on. We agree on what's the issue in a certain part of the game, and I will say it my way. He will say it in his way, and you know, sometimes a combination of those two makes things click easier.
Yeah, I want to also mention, we talked about him getting into the top 10, which is a great achievement. It happened faster than you thought. How do you deal with something like that when, because your life changes when all of a sudden everything's thrown at you, from whether it's interviews to meetings to stardom to having the attention on you. What's the best way, do you think, for a player to be able to handle that and manage all that?
Well, I think, you know, it's been coming in waves. You know, we had a big interest after Roland Garros and after Munich, when you won Munich, you know, so things have been coming. And I guess as a young person developing in the game and developing his own personality, it's a lot, you know, that's coming on you. So for me personally, I think, you know, the most important thing is to be grounded and have a solid base and have good values. And Holger has that. So I think also that, as I told you, it came in waves. I think his ability to handle the popularity now is better than if it came just out of nothing.
Mm-hmm. And what's your opinion on how to be able to stay grounded?
Well, I think it's important to have a team around you that you can trust, and a team around you who are mature enough not to just go on the roller coaster, but can guide you in a good way. And I mean, that's also a good thing that Patrick is bringing in, because he's been in this game for 10 years with Serena, so he knows everything about it and can guide Holger and can guide his mother.
And how about you? How are you dealing with everything? The fact that so much is, I mean, there's probably a lot more travel for you. You know, being able to handle that, because it's a big investment that you've put in him from such a young age.
It is, and I mean, the travel part, it's obviously it's a little bit more than it was usually, but we've been traveling since he was 10 years old, and I've been traveling in my jobs before for many years, so for me it doesn't make that big a difference. So I don't feel, personally, I don't feel the big difference, and I'm not really so much into all this fame thing, you know, so I keep my distance. I'm a pretty grounded person myself.
Yeah, you seem it, yeah. You are very calm. What do you guys like to do outside of tennis for fun?
Well,
to get away, because you need that mental break sometimes,
yeah,
right?
I mean, Holger's so much into tennis, so he will normally, when he's not on the side, he will sit with his iPad and watch tennis clips. And
who does he like to watch the most?
It depends. He was very much into all the big guys. You know, he's been very much into Federer when he was younger, and he's been into Rafa, he's been into Djokovic, and, you know, several players. And yeah, sometimes it's hard for the coach, because he adapts so easy. So when there was a time, sometimes, you know, he comes and I can see he's been watching a little bit too much this player or that player, and I have to say, you cannot reproduce his technique. We're working on your technique, so but that's
luckily a challenge for you.
Yeah, it's a challenge. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it's developing for him, because he is capable of doing so many different things. Mm. But sometimes, and that's one of the things that's coming together right now is that he's found his personality. He's still influenced by everything what's going on, but his
how so has he found his personality?
I think, you know, being a young kid, you know, you're watching Medvedev. He's the best in the world in the beginning of the year, and he's playing amazing tennis, and his style, he's like tall and he's serving big, and but he's very defensive in his way of playing tennis. And I mean, Holger's explosive and is built to stay closer to the baseline, so adapting the style of Daniil is not really beneficial for his game. So those things come up occasionally.
Are there certain players that you would prefer he watch?
No, I wouldn't say so. Mm-hmm. For me, you know, I've always, when I started building on Holger from the beginning of, I was always taking the best from the best guys. So I was watching Djokovic's footwork and his ability to stay close to the baseline, the way he returns. I was watching Roger's offensive game, how he approaches the net, how he serves, and being early and aggressive on the ball. And I was watching a lot of Rafa, how he was grinding on the clay court, you know, and his will to put in the extra shot and do angles and a lot of spin and stuff like that. And I try to pick the best of everybody and try to build Holger on these inputs.
And what do you find unique about Holger after pinpointing certain things about Rafa, Roger, and Novak?
Well, I find Holger's a fantastic competitor. He wants it so much, and he doesn't see it as a sacrifice to work every day and be in the tennis world 100%. When he was a kid, he wouldn't have avoided to go to birthday with other kids because he wanted to practice. So it's never been a question of, for him, if he should practice the whole time or if he should go out and have fun with his friends or something like that. And I mean, if you have that attitude towards what you really like and what's your job now, it's a fantastic asset. And then he's technically the things we're working on that should be even better, but technically I see him as a complete player, and he's still had so much room for improvement in many areas of this game, and off court as well, and physically is a room for improvement in so many areas. So I think he's got what it takes to be the best.
To be the best, sometimes you have to learn from the best, and there aren't many better than John McEnroe, Bjorn Borg, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, Juan Carlos Ferrero, Leighton Hewitt, Bob Bryan, and Roger Federer. Incredibly, they all sat down with ATP Uncovered to pick out some of their favourite moments and memories, starting with Mr. McEnroe.
You never know when you're a kid. I mean, I was the best junior in the world, but everything's unpredictable. I mean, I had high hopes, but I don't think anyone assumes you're going to be number one in the world. They hear a few murmurs from people that you have the ability to do it and got some positive feedback, but it's a long way to go to prove it. So it's it happened quicker than I would have thought in a way, but it felt like it was a long time coming by that time.
Well, I think it's an achievement that one can be very proud of, because not many players have got to the number one spot, especially if you look at the year-end ranking and looking back, you know, that you can tell your kids once up a time, a long time ago, you were the number one player in the world. And it takes a long time, because I think your first aim is to win a Grand Slam. That's what you dream about. But getting to the number one, it's a target which is not easy, because you have to play well over such a long period of time, and to get there is a challenge, and even more of a challenge to stay at number one spot.
This is your sixth Waterford number one trophy. You've done what no player has ever done before. We couldn't be more proud of you. Congratulations.
To be consistent in any sport is tough to do, and 6 years in a row was a lot of work, some stress involved, and a great achievement. I mean, to really dominate that 6 years was not easy, and I wanted it. I sacrificed and worked hard and won some tennis matches along the way, but it wasn't easy.
it's all sort of worked together to really teach me a lot in life. I mean, I've really enjoyed these last 20 years, even though there have been so many moments that were tougher than others. But I think overall, it's just the relationships you really grow to love and miss the most.
Oh, of course he was going to do that.
Having the tournament here in Valencia to end our careers, the Valencian guys, tennis players, it's very special. We are very lucky to have the tournament here.
To know that all the hard yards and sacrifices that you make, pay off, and just sitting back and for me there was always the opportunity of playing for Australia and winning Davis Cups and trying to get to the pinnacle of our sport and holding up a Grand Slam trophy. And within a couple of years on tour, I was fortunate enough to have all three.
We always got so much enjoyment out of playing dubs. We played singles and doubles growing up as juniors, and it seemed to make for a great tournament if we could go home with the doubles trophies and both be happy.
I mean, when you look back at it, we're still kind of blown away by it.
The best doubles team of all time, Bob and Mike Bryan.
Well, in an era of tennis kings, its founding father says farewell.
We'll get through this somehow, will we? Right? Look, it's been a wonderful day. I told the guys I'm happy. I'm not sad. So it feels great to be here.
Messrs. Bryan, Hewitt, Ferrero, Agassi, Sampras, Borg and McEnroe. And ending, of course, with Roger Federer. And we have more from Roger at the end of the podcast. All those greats share one thing in common. They all rose to number one in singles, but only one of them, John McEnroe, also managed the feat in doubles, where our focus now falls. Wesley Kohlhoff and Neil Skupski finished the year as the world's top pair, and Jill Krabus recently sat down with the man who's guided their fortunes over the past couple of years, Rob Morgan.
The first thing that I always try and create with a player, and myself and Wes did this before we actually began the working relationship, was, what's the goal? Where do we want to be? And share a vision. And that's something that we created a lot of time to put detail into that. What does it look like? Where do we want to be in the end of the year? And the goal at the start of the year was to be number one as a team and to be number one as an individual. And Wes and Neil, they both done that. So I think sharing a vision is a massive part of coaching, and we created that very early, and we put things in place and got it done. So
congratulations on becoming year-end number one. The vision that you're talking about, is that something you do periodically throughout the year? You start that way, obviously have a vision, but do you consistently talk about that throughout the year?
Yeah, definitely. I think painting a picture regularly to the player is vital. And things change week on week depending on success or failure, quote unquote, depending on what you class that as. Things change, and it's about adapting to the player's needs, whether that's doing a little more, a little less, whatever it may be. So yeah, but I think in our case, and in Wes's case especially, it's been to consistently paint that picture week on week about where he wants to be by the end of the year. And now we have a new goal, which was one of the goals, I guess, for this year as well, which is to win a Grand Slam next year. So that's going to be in the forefront of our mind as a team.
And how much as a coach are you also trying to develop the person, or is the vision solely about the playing, the strategy, or do you develop the person as well?
Yeah, good question. I think personally, open-minded people tend to be the best people to work with. You're not trying to change them. You're trying to bring their personality and their strengths to the right at the top. I think that's something that I've consciously worked on a lot as a coach over the years, is making sure that you are bringing the best out of the person off the court as well, which a happy person off the court normally results into a happy person on the court. A good relationship with the coach allows the coach to challenge the player in in more ways than one, and when they feel comfortable with a coach, that's going to be a massive bonus. Is if you are comfortable with someone and trust someone to challenge you, you're more than likely going to get more out of yourself as a player.
What tactics would you use to challenge the person in particular?
Well, I think effective questioning. You know, I think the first thing, when I started with Wes, he was ranked 21, 22 in the world. Sometimes you'd hear me say to Wes, is that top 10? Is that the top 10 level, how that is?
First, like during all, a practice or
during
a match?
During a practice session, okay, yeah. But okay, obviously, prior to that conversation, you know, you establish the goals with him. And, you know, he told me that he wanted to be one as an individual and one as a team. So, okay, Wes, are you comfortable for me to challenge you to those standards? Because previously I'd got players to number one from that same spot, from 20, Joe and Rajiv. And I know it works in challenging players with that almost being comfortable with putting them on the spot. I think sometimes players are very strong-willed people. They're very confident in what they do. But often I think coaches can be maybe a little scared to ask those questions. Is that good enough? You know, sometimes I think I see it a lot where coaches are afraid to challenge someone in some way, which might maybe come back at them with a response that maybe they don't want to hear. But I feel like the openness and honesty of open communication is something where you build that trust. And even if I say something that's wrong, if we're all on the same page of where we want to go, then I'm going to learn from it, they're going to learn from it, and we're going to ask different questions next time. I think creating that safe environment of just being okay with someone coming back at you with something, if that does happen, not saying it has all the time, but you know, you've got to create that safety of, I'm going to be honest, I want you to be honest with me.
I mean, how do you do that? I mean, what is your approach? Because there's so many different personalities, yeah, that you would probably work with in a lot of these players.
Listen. You've got to listen to the person. And I think that's the best way to get to know them, is to listen to them. How they communicate, how they take feedback, what they say, what are they really trying to say. And that's a skill that I'm always looking to get better at that sort of stuff. So listening to really what they're saying is a big thing. Instead of dictating to them as a player, it's a conversation, it's questions. You know, whether I ask them the most simple question and then listen to what they say for 5 minutes, that might just be what they need. But I think listening is a big skill to be able to get to know them well.
And how did you get to this stage? Who did you listen to that helped you have this philosophy or perspective? Who are your mentors?
Well, I think I've always been confident in myself. I do have some people around me that I trust in, that I seek advice from. One of them is my brother, and he's younger than me. He's an unbelievable listener. So I took a lot from him. I have someone else.
What did you learn from him in particular?
He just doesn't talk that much.
Just to be quiet.
Well, he listens unbelievably well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm pretty extroverted. And I think when I started coaching 14 years ago, I was definitely guilty of talking too much. But I was also very confident in getting things wrong. And if I got things wrong, I was okay with it. I knew I was going to get better. But yeah, my journey's been, I started at grassroots, you know, working my way from junior tennis and even some beginners right at the start after I stopped playing to a, you know, high national level, futures level. And I guess I was just okay with failing. It's such a cliche thing, isn't it, that you see on these YouTube motivational videos of, you know, fail better. You know, I truly embrace that in general. I'm okay with, you know, getting stuff wrong, and then I know I'm going to make it right next time, whatever it is. And that philosophy of, you know, just being open, being honest, and I think the right people will fall around you if you bring that kind of vulnerability to a conversation. I think it's powerful.
So what would you say you failed better at?
Good question. I haven't had that much that I can say that I've failed in terms of, you know, like a bad relationship with someone as a player or a coach, as a player-coach relationship, sorry, should I say, but I feel like I've failed within myself at times where I've gone, okay, I need to structure my conversation better next time, or maybe my goals aren't high enough for the player. I can always review myself after a year and say, how can I get better at that? How can I get better at that? So I suppose there's multiple things. I can't put a pinpoint on it right like now, but on reflection, I might see where I can definitely make stronger improvements for the next time. The more you watch, the more you listen, the more you're going to learn.
I was going to ask you about that, because I was when you were focusing on listening so much, when you're in the box watching matches, I guess you could call it kind of a listening by watching, right? And so what are the most impactful things you've picked up by watching and observing throughout? I mean, I'm not even saying just this year, but throughout your coaching career.
During matches, between points is a big giveaway.
In between points,
change of ends, looking at the facial expressions. I mean, you've been a player, like you'll look down the other end and you'll see telltale signs of your opponent. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it just takes you 3 seconds to come out of your own little bubble, take a little look down the other side of the court, see what's really going on down there. So that's the same for me as a coach. I'm going to be looking not always at the ball, just sometimes at Wes, sometimes at the opponents and what I see. You know, some people might find that a little bit strange, but when you're sat on the side of the court and the ball's going left, right, it's difficult to see things. So sometimes you might just be watching just for one point exactly what they do. And now that you can coach on the side, that might give you something that you can give to your player.
Yeah, do you like the coaching?
Mixed.
Okay.
Mixed on it. Mixed in terms of it's new. I'm still a little bit uncertain. Do I like it? I'm unsure. Positive side is it's helped at times this year. Being able to talk to Wes at certain times, giving me a little bit of feedback here and there, whether it's even just, you know, being able to feel a little bit more free in praising him on specific things. I feel like you've got a little bit more freedom in how you can talk and signal maybe a little bit. So I like that side of it. But I feel like it's how you view it. If you see it as an opportunity to tell your player, you know, go here, go there, go here, go there. If you look at it that way, then you might be setting yourself up to fail, because it might not always go here, go there. So I think it's just opening a door of positivity in terms of the game is evolving, which I like. But I still, I guess, I'm a little bit uncertain of how the dynamic actually will always work. With the player. I did it a bit when I was coaching Heather Watson a few years ago, going on the change of ends mic'd up. I wasn't a fan of that, because sometimes coach player, and by the way, the camera's in your face at this point, sometimes the coach player chat isn't the greatest.
isn't the most friendly.
Yeah, but that stuff happens, but I think that's part and parcel of the importance of being thick-skinned as a coach, which I am. And learning from that again.
I want to ask you about the watching in between the points. Do you encourage your players, like Wes, to pay attention to that too?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, pre-match chat. Don't be afraid to have a look down the other end of the court and just see what's going on.
And has he noticed anything in particular that's helped him?
Yeah, I think each opponent presents different things. Each team presents different, you know, telltale signs. I think in doubles, every team, I believe, will show a sign of weakness at some point in the match. And you've got to be ready to scope that out.
And to find out more about Rob Morgan and his work, check out his new Academy's website, m2performanceacademy.uk.
You're listening to the ATP Tennis Radio Podcast.
2 years ago, Slovakia's Alex Molchan sat outside the top 300 in the Pepperstone ATP rankings. Ending 2022, he's 50 in the world, having teamed up with Novak Djokovic's former longtime coach Marijan Vida and former Davis Cup finalist Carl Beck. Coincidence or consequence? Chris Bowers asked the question.
To be honest, I respect every coach very much. I respect them both, of course. Marianne is probably the best coach ever. I can say that. I think he is. And Carol, he was not coaching any great player before, but I still believed and I knew that he's capable of because he was a talented player. He understands the game very well. He's really good. He sees many things. So and they both, like, they combined. It's incredibly good energy. We have a lot of fun. They understand each other as coaches, and so they are not fighting about some that I have this opinion and he has this opinion. They always find a way together and also with me. So that's working out pretty well.
How do they divide the work?
I don't know. When I'm practicing at home, they are both on the practices. So I don't know. Hard to say. As I said, there is some good chemistry between us, between our team. So we don't have these problems. That we don't have any problems actually. So it's really working and it's really fun.
And when you say Marianne is probably the best coach, what makes him that?
I don't know. If you look at the Grand Slams of his former player he was coaching, probably you can see it, right? So I think Grand Slams talks about itself. So,
and when one looks at your big surge in results, a big point was when you got to the final in Belgrade and you played Djokovic. What did you learn from that?
Yeah, I was saying actually that in a lot of interviews that match, or I would say, okay, that tournament changed a lot because I regained my confidence back. That was the key for me to, you know, After that, I was playing really good the whole season, and playing against Djokovic that really showed me how is the tennis played, and it's not about playing crazy fast or trying to be extremely aggressive. It's about head, and you know Djokovic is playing. It looks like he's playing chess. It was really incredible experience. I learned a lot from it. I saw how maybe I can play. Not exactly, but some moves, how he's thinking. I was rewatching this match a lot, and the experience was amazing, and it was good school for me.
And you played him again in Roland Garros 2022, and then you played Alcaraz in the semi-finals in Hamburg, all of them on clay. How do you compare where Alcaraz and Djokovic are, having been on the opposite side of the net against both of them?
I started with Alcaraz. Alcaraz is... He's playing so fast. It's incredible. He's playing crazy aggressive. Crazy. He's fit. He runs. He catch everything. Also Djokovic. Also he's running incredibly. But they're different players. And it was with Alcaraz, it was a tough match actually. It was really tough. Once you do short ball to his forehand, it's probably over. So that's different. But Djokovic, when I was playing against him in Roland Garros, I was a little bit stressed, of course. It was on Susan Langland. For me,
it's a big court for you and a small one for him.
Yeah. Also, I think also he was probably stressed because Marianne was on the other side. Yeah. So also I think Marianne was a little bit stressed. But it was a good match. In third set, I was up. I was 5-4. It was 30-all, I think, 6-5 deuce. So I was pretty close to get his first set, but then he showed why he's one of the greatest players of all time. But it was a nice match and a great experience also.
You've been runner-up three times at tour events this year, Lyon, Marrakesh. What is the thing missing from winning a tour event?
Good question. I was pretty close in Marrakesh. I was set breakup, I think 40-15. I could go for 3-1 in second against Goffin. But I made some mistakes and then he went crazy up in his game. And so then I lost. And also against Nori in Lyon, it was third set. And I don't know, something was missing probably. My head was not working when I started to losing. And so I think it's pretty much all about the head in this type of matches. So I know what can I do better next time if I'm in finals. So we'll see.
What do you think the next step is for you in your tennis career?
Of course, I have things in my mind. I'm not going to talk about it right now. I have some goals set. I have something in my head, what I want to improve. And for me, I need to improve a lot of things. And I know that if I'm going to work on that, I'll be a more dangerous player. So I believe that that's going to work, what we are speaking with my coaches about. And we'll see next year how it goes. But I'm confident.
You seem to know your own mind.
Yeah, of course. I'm thinking by myself. I always trying to think by myself.
All the very best.
Thank you very much.
One man who's done a lot of thinking this year is Sergei Stakhovsky of the Ukraine. One day he was playing on the ATP Tour, ranked 31. The next, he was a soldier fighting near the front line in eastern Ukraine. In November, he made a brief trip to Turin to take part in a ceremony alongside other recently retired players. And he joined Jill Krabus for one of the more significant tennis chats of 2022. They started with home and family.
I'm alive. The family's safe. They're in Budapest. They're warm. They're fed. They go to school. So I guess everything's good with them.
You guys have gone through a lot. So how are you doing in particular?
We all hope that we are okay, but unfortunately we don't know that. We will know that later, I guess. Yes, it's unprecedented times. It's a war. So, I mean, everybody's trying to live through it to the standards he can.
And just obviously came in, can you describe your outfit? You came in your
National
Army gear,
Guard, yes.
National
yeah.
Guard gear, yeah. And a Ukrainian flag. And when you walked in today, how was that reception for you today?
Interesting. I think a lot of guys didn't recognize me, which was good, because I definitely felt out of place a little bit.
You did? Why?
I don't know. It's I've been to the Paris this year, but it was different because, you know, it was just the beginning, and I was in Kiev in terror defense. And I went to States, I was in US Open. That already felt surreal because the contrast of what we experience and what's going on there in civil cities. But yet again, it wasn't hit hard in Kiev. I was stationed a couple of weeks in Kharkiv. It was shelled, but nothing that major. And then coming here after the Kiev been hit multiple times in city center, so very heart of the Kiev was hit by missiles, coming to the city where it's quiet and peaceful and you know, people having fun on the tennis court and cheering for tennis, is different.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that perspective because obviously you played for a while. You're here. I did see you at the U.S. Open, but you're here in Turin because a lot of players that have retired are congregating together. Is that a weird experience for you, or has your perspective changed as far as tennis?
I think it's great that ATP does it. Celebrating the retirements of the players from different layers of the rankings. Just for me, this year is out of place. I mean, I would definitely enjoy it significantly more if there would be no war and, you know, and we would all come to the peaceful ceremony. But the circumstances as they are, and we are usually not the hostages, but we respond to our decisions. And I'm here carrying my decision today, and I'll come back to Ukraine when it's done.
And how much have you spoken to the other players that are here that are retired? There's quite a few here.
No, we talked. The only problem is that it's very hard to say something from them even. You know, what to talk what? To talk about the family problems or life problems. I mean, I understand that it's a burden for them as well to communicate because it's hard. What can I say? They're very sorry, and I know that they are, and they all say it, but you know, there's very hard to discuss any topics beyond the relationship that there's a war and there's a death and there's people dying every day.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to sort of ask about tennis because you just said it's strange, right, seeing everyone have fun on the tennis court. You had a great career. I mean, it feels strange. You did.
A decent one.
Yeah, you had a great career. But it feels strange to ask about it in a way, but do you reflect on it at all in any way or think about it?
No, I think definitely I think about when I retired. And for me, I expected to be more emotional. For me, most emotional part of my retirement was when I lost to Ruud in last year's Davis Cup. Actually, it was 27th of November, I think. And for me, that was the moment when I knew that it's done. I knew that I'm going to go to Australia, but it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be that. So for me, psychologically, that was the day when I finished. And taking back where I've been, yes, it was a great ride. I spent lots of times in great places and meeting new people and did what I loved. So I was lucky that I didn't have to work a day in my life. But on the other hand, I think I could have done better, surely. But I got a bit emotional in the Players' Council, and those things, they got my emotional side as well, and they deflate my potential maybe a little bit. But on the other hand, again, I come from Ukraine with zero support, and where me and Sasha Dolgopolov and Ilya Marchenko, were, which heights that we reached, whether it was for long or for the short period, I think it's great for all of us. And I just hope that eventually, in years to come, we will be able to get the tennis back in Ukraine and to support the youth, because right now there's no future.
And how were you guys able to support each other when you didn't have that support? How were you able to get through, do you think?
I think it's the best part about having the same people from, I mean, your countrymen competing against you is just the competition. You know, that drive to become Ukrainian world number one or Ukraine number two or number three, and constant push that, you know, you want to be a bit better. We're good relations. We're friends, all of us. I mean, we talk. But that little edge there, you know, that you want to be number one in the end of the year in your country. You want to be number one in Davis Cup.
Yeah.
That thing's pushing. And I'm grateful to Sasha, because once he stepped in, my ranking improved. I mean, I entered the top 100. I think I was 79 or 80, and I was there for about a year and a half or two. And then when Sasha came along and he started to progress and start to show real good results, you know, I came up and I started to play better and I started to push. So it's always a combination.
What do you, I mean, as athletes, you always want to achieve more than you have. What do you wish you could have achieved? What were your dreams?
I wish I could have been better in the Grand Slams. I mean, I reached multiple times third round of all the Grand Slams, but never beyond that. And that's something that I really, really regret. I do believe I could do better. Yes, sometimes the draw, sometimes the emotion could be different, but that's something I do regret.
For me, I always feel like from tennis you learn so much. I think about life in general. Is that, do you take anything away from your career that you feel like has helped you now as far as in your life or with your family?
No, tennis gives you a life and it teaches you a lot. I mean, you travel, you have to be able to do everything by yourself. You have to, I mean, unless you're coming from a very rich country and with a lot of finances, you have a managers and a team around you, but predominantly you come from your own. You have to structure and you have to prepare and you have to have faith in yourself and do everything by yourself, because the great part about tennis is it doesn't matter how many people coaches you. When you step on a tennis court, you're there alone and you have to deal with yourself with all the things coming at you. And you either win by yourself or you lose by yourself, but you do it by yourself. And that's, I think, that tennis really teaches us to have a character where we are able to comprehend any obstacles which are coming along the way.
And from here in Turin, what is next for you? Where do you go back home?
I have a couple of days off. I'm going to fly to Bordeaux when I'm going to play my last match for my loved club Primrose in Bordeaux.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they do a little goodbye. And then,
is it an exhibition or what?
No, it's a French club championship.
Oh, nice.
So, and I played for that club for 12 years, so it's a great honor that I could spend that much time with them.
And that's where you're finishing?
And that's where I'm going to finish it, yes.
That's amazing. Yeah. Are they going to have a celebration for you?
I don't know, but I think yes, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a club with a lot of winemakers as members, and the sponsors of the club are the very good Chateaus of Bordeaux, so I do believe some wines will be spilled.
Do you like wine?
I got into, yes, because of them I drink wine, only because of I've started to play for Bordeaux, and they basically, I don't know how they put me on a needle of wine, and I can say that I'm a little bit addicted, yes, to the culture of wine, not to the wine as a product, but to the culture of wine and winemaking.
What do you like about the culture of winemaking?
The history, the tradition, that you can create something. It's like art, you're creating a wine. I have a winery in Ukraine, so
you do?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, it's in Ukraine, it's a bit tricky now.
Yeah. Well, is it? I mean, where is it in Ukraine?
It's good part. We're lucky. We're in the western part. We're on the border with Hungary. But for the last 3 days, we have no electricity.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. How long have you had this winery?
We started in 2015 with a wine plot, and basically we started to sell our first vintage in 2018, and we started to sell it in 2020. So it's fairly upcoming project, which was first hit by the COVID. Then we got some wings and we got a good result. And then, unfortunately, Russia invaded Ukraine, and it all went to shenanigans.
Okay. Well, I mean, we're all hoping, obviously, peace comes soon.
Thank you.
And after your exhibition or your club match, you go back to Budapest for a little bit?
And then back to Ukraine, yes.
And then back to Ukraine. Okay. Well, obviously, we're wishing all the best to you and your family. But we appreciate the time. And, of course, congratulations on a great career. But stay safe.
We'll try that. Thanks.
Well said, Jill. And our thoughts go out to everyone in the Ukraine. May they all stay safe. Finally this week, and sticking with the retirement theme, there was arguably none bigger in the men's game in 2022 than that of Roger Federer, who called time on a truly illustrious career at the Laver Cup. 103 career titles, 20 of which Grand Slams, 310 weeks at world number one. The numbers are staggering, and at the recent Swiss Sports Awards, Federer was presented with an honorary prize and labelled the perfect sporting icon.
I've definitely given, I feel like, everything and more to my career than what I could have done. I got to enjoy and learn what hard work and dedication means. And for that, I'm forever grateful to my coaches and my teams that have pushed me there. Fitness coach Pierre, Severin, everybody. They have been incredible. So for me, I don't know how much more I could have given, could have tried. I tried, I feel, a lot of different things, a lot of different ways, but also I'm old enough now to call it a day, and I feel really good about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome the world number one player, Mr. Roger Federer!
My proudest achievement, it could be world number one. It's the pinnacle, you know, it's the, being the best. And I didn't just do it for, you know, one day. I did it, I think, a record maybe of length. So that was special, of course, my first Wimbledon title. And just making it as a player, you know, onto the tour, top 100. I think that was a big deal in itself already. I never thought I was going to have such a successful career.
The tennis world is at its feet.
I think walking out to fans and being able to play in the most incredible arenas, stadiums around the world, I think that's been it, really. Of course, then we can go into details what I like about the game in itself, the forehands, the backhands, half volleys, drop shots, the feel, you know, off the ball on a nice racket with its strings. It's everything to me. So yeah, I had a great time. It's been nice, you know, to see the impact and the messages we have seen and received, direct or indirectly. It's been a busy period. I feel like I had knots in my tummy for a long time now, so I'm happy finally the news is out. But it's been overwhelming, to be quite honest, how many nice things have been written about me, a lot of them about my personality and about me as a person, less almost as me as the tennis player and my forehand and whatever you want to call it. And I think that's been a wonderful surprise to me, that a lot of people looked or supported me because of maybe my character. You know, that was a bit of unexpected twist to the story. I thought that we were going to talk about his achievements, his accomplishment, what he meant for the game, and that's it. But it was much more than that. So I think it totally overexceeded my expectations.
Roger Federer has been impenetrable, yet graceful. The man considered by many to be the GOAT.
I know I want to, and I have to find something that makes me really happy within the game, however that is. Mentoring, I don't know, idea, commentating, I don't know. Just in a capacity that brings me back to tournaments and gives me a chance to interact with the tennis community. I've always been a big supporter of the future of the game, and I really think it's been a great last few years. The game always creates new superstars and great stories. So for me, I never worried about the game. People thought tennis was not so cool and great anymore once Sampras and Agassi retired. Here I was like, I'm sorry, it's kind of me also with Roddick and Ferrero and Hewitt especially. So for me to now look at the future, I know it's incredibly bright and we don't have to worry about it on either side, men and women. I think it's going to be great and I will be following closely, of course. And I think this is definitely a moment, a big moment for me to thank everybody who has always supported me. I feel the Federer fans became more and more as the older I got. It's been incredible when I cried on court, you know, and I brought tears to sport or to tennis. I know it's happened in the past, but I was probably quite famous for it. I'm happy I lived through those emotions, but at the same time, it made me really appreciate the moment and it will never be forgotten. So, if I had all these emotions on court, it was because the fans, they know that, I know that. And that is the things, those things I'm gonna miss. Traveling around the world and having somebody wait for me and just being so excited to see me. That's why I wrote in the letter that, you know, I love tennis, and I will see you again kind of thing. For me, it was important to remind the fans, I will not leave the game. I will be there. People will get a chance to see me again. And we'll have moments again. They might be different, but they will be beautiful moments. And for me, it was important to remind myself that, but especially also the fans who I'm so very thankful to.
Born by Federer has made it. Oh, what an amazing shot. Oh, come on. Oh, sublime from Federer. The touch, the feel, and again, the execution.
Oh, no. That's impossible. And somehow Federer makes it possible.
Roger, from all in tennis and everywhere around the world, thank you very much. That is also a very good way to draw a line under 2022, but don't worry, next week we will usher in 2023 with another cracking programme that will also help you all work off that festive season excess, because we have a fitness special. Hope you can join us then.